Case number 24-1088, World Shipping Council Petitioner versus Federal Maritime Commission and United States of America. Mr. Hughes for the petitioner, Mr. Summers for the respondents.
Morning, counsel. Mr. Hughes, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, Paul Hughes for the petitioner, World Shipping Council. This case addresses whether an ocean carrier may bill a motor carrier for demurrage or detention charges when two conditions are present. The first is an ocean carrier has a contract with a motor carrier, and the second is that the motor carrier, through its own fault, delays the timely movement of containers. In our comment letter, we squarely presented this issue to the commission, and in issuing the rule, the FMC agreed with our position. It said, quote, nothing in the rule prohibits an ocean carrier from issuing a demurrage or detention invoice to a motor carrier when a contractual relationship exists. That's a joint appendix 254. But the regulation itself, section 541.4, bars billing in these circumstances. When we pointed this out after the rule issued, at first, the general counsel told us that they agreed with our position, but then later they corrected the rule by striking this preamble text. But they didn't strike it completely because this issue still exists with respect to marine terminal operators, where they say that marine terminal operators can bill motor carriers, and they give justification for that in the preamble, but that's also in conflict with the regulatory text as drafted. We think section 541.4 is unlawful for four principal reasons. I'm going to take these in slight different order from the brief. I think the first and most straightforward basis is that there's simply a failure to respond to a material comment. There was a response, but that response agreed with us. It got removed, and there's no response to this particular issue. The second point is simply a failure to explain. I should say these issues are interrelated, but there's no explanation as to why billing is disallowed in these circumstances. The third is a violation of the incentive principle, which exists both as a statutory and a regulatory matter. And our fourth point is that for FMC to say that all billing in these circumstances is disallowed, there needs to be a determination that such billing is unjust and unreasonable, and there is no determination as to this billing being unjust and unreasonable. Now, my friend is going to say that there are abuses and problems with demurrage and detention, and that regulation is important. And I want to be clear, we don't disagree with the broad principle, either that FMC can generally regulate demurrage and detention charges, nor that there are certain abuses that are appropriately regulated by the FMC. We agree with all of that, and my friend is going to point to parts of the regulation where he identifies those abuses and says there's an appropriate regulatory response. Again, we agree with all of that. We are focused on when there's a contractual relationship between the ocean carrier and the motor carrier, and it's the motor carrier's fault for the delay. And the only place in the regulation that addresses that issue agrees with us, saying that there can be billing, even though that's contrary to the regulatory text that was provided.
And so on that part of it, so is it the JA 257 to 258 that you're relying on, where it's pages 14339 to 14340, I think, because I think the point you're making now is, even if you give effect to the correction, which removes the paragraph in which the preamble most clearly took the position that you support, there's still something left in the preamble that still supports the position that you support. And I just want to make sure that I'm understanding that that part you're pointing to.
Yes, Your Honor. It is the at 257 to 258. It's that paragraph that carries over about the marine terminal operators, because it's talking there in that marine terminal operator context. It's discussing a schedule that may be at the terminal and says if there is billing pursuant to that schedule, it's clear and consistent. It provides notice to the trucker and it can be enforced as an implied contract.
Right. So it specifically talks about treating the schedule as an implied contract. And so I just want to make sure that your position is focused on situations in which there's a contract, whether implied or express, but it's focused on situations in which there's a contract, not other situations in which a motor carrier might be the subject of the fee.
That's correct, Your Honor. We're principally focused on what's called carrier haulage. These are circumstances where, by their nature, the ocean carrier has a contract with the motor carrier. And so my friend is going to point to other parts.
Before you move on, my reading of this language at JA 257 to 258 in the terminal schedule is that if the terminal schedule has some provisions in it about wharf demurrage, if I'm saying this word correctly, then those can be invoiced or billed. That's when I read the rules about what terminal schedules can include. It says wharf demurrage is one of the fees that can be specified in a terminal schedule, but that doesn't solve the problem of detention. If a motor carrier doesn't return the storage container in a timely fashion, that's not addressed in a terminal schedule. So even as far as this goes, it doesn't address the other part of the problem, right?
Well, I think it could potentially be addressed in the tariff, but Your Honor, my principal point is what this says in the page of the preamble that you can do with marine terminal operators is contradicted by the regulation that's actually adopted by 551.4. So even though this preamble says you can bill motor carriers if there is a tariff that provides this clarity for, to say, demurrage, as Your Honor was suggesting, the actual regulatory text that the FMC adopted prohibits billing in those circumstances. So we're in a situation where the explanation—
So you're saying that we should not read an exception into the regulatory text because they didn't write it, that we shouldn't construe the regulatory text to have the exception that the preamble says that it does.
Well, and Your Honor, this is why we had this, we included the email exchange between the then president of my client with the general counsel of the FMC, because after this rule came out, we said, well, this is peculiar because the on the face of the preamble, it seems from a policy matter, the commission has taken our position and agrees with us, but then how it's reduced it to regulation bars billing in these circumstances. The first response from the FMC is, we agree with you, you can bill in these circumstances, and here's how we think it's consistent with the regulatory.
It's clear it's not a response from the commission, it's a response from the general counsel, and the general counsel doesn't speak for the commission, right?
Of course, Your Honor, I just think this provides some context, because that was the first thing, though, that we were told. When we explain why we think it's challenging, if not impossible, really impossible, to read the regulatory text that way, the next thing we found was the correction that removed part of the language, not all of the language. And now my friends are taking the position, contrary to the email exchange, that we cannot bill, that it is, they're not suggesting that I'm wrong here in submitting how we read 541.4. They're saying it is a flat ban on billing motor carriers in all circumstances, even when there is a contract. And again, that's why I think the most basic way to resolve this case is this was clearly at issue in the regulation. My client put it at issue through their comment letter. The FMC thought it was at issue because it addressed it meaningfully, responded to the comments and said, your comment is, they said it's a based on misunderstanding because you can bill in these circumstances. Recognizing billing in these circumstances is reasonable. That was the position that the FMC took. And to Your Honor's point, as the commission, that's what the commission said. And the commission as commission, now that they're telling us we cannot bill, has never given a reasoned articulation of why we cannot bill.
Can I ask you this question? So the correction comes about subsequently after the email exchange.
Yep.
I take it that you're not challenging the correction. Because I don't know that I have, is there a situation in which there's a correction to a rule in this way that doesn't itself go through some sort of procedural formalities that attend an amendment to a rule or a new rule?
Your Honor, I don't know what legal weight the correction has because it didn't undertake notice and comment rulemaking, but it certainly, it doesn't actually add any explanation. So if FMC had tried to say, well, we're providing the explanation that was missing in the original rule through the correction, we could have a discussion as to whether or not that's legally permissible. But the correction doesn't even attempt to do that. It just strikes the language, leaving us with a void. So there is no discussion or explanation of billing in these circumstances.
So for your purposes, I mean, you didn't challenge the correction. So you're fine with us taking the correction as legally valid. You just think that even with the correction, it doesn't get them all the way home because there's still a problem. But I'm right in understanding as a predicate matter that you don't actually challenge.
We had petitioned for review prior to the issuance of the correction. So the correction occurred after a petition for review.
But you also didn't raise anything in your brief about the validity of the correction.
I think that's right, Your Honor. But again, I don't think the correction has any substantive weight. It doesn't address the issues that we have put forward, because there's nothing in the correction, taking it as fully valid, that answers our fundamental challenges. Again, I think easiest is they needed to respond. Second, they needed to give explanation. Third, the substantive result reached is in conflict with the incentive principle. The incentive principle exists both as a statutory matter, and even if there are questions about that, it certainly exists as a regulatory matter that the commission itself has adopted.
But it doesn't matter to you. I mean, that's getting to the statutory argument. In terms of the various grounds that you put forward, you started with the other one, and that one is just as good.
Your Honor, I think the easiest route for the court is a very simple APA-based argument of the commission had an obligation to address this issue. It didn't. That's a basis to vacate and remand without having to engage in any statutory interpretation.
As arbitrary and capricious.
Yes, as arbitrary and capricious. I think that would be a very sufficient way to resolve the case without some of the other, what I put as my third argument, the conflict with the incentive principle, and the fourth argument, the conflict with 41-102, because that would require a determination that is unjust and unreasonable. That would require the court to engage in statutory construction or regulatory construction, which we would be happy to discuss. Again, in preparing for argument, that's why I inverted the order, because I think the arbitrary and capricious arguments are very straightforward in terms of failure to respond to comments and failure to provide explain reasoning. To me, it's harder to see a more clear-cut case where we knew this issue was before the commission. It was a material, significant issue the commission thought it had to respond to. It decided it favorably, and it, at least in its preamble discussion, we thought we had prevailed on this issue. Now they tell us that we cannot bill, but there's no justification for that in the context of the rule.
I was going to say, I'd like to visit your proposed remedies. Are you asking for the whole rule to be vacated or just the 541.4?
We're focused on 541.4, Your Honor. Okay. That is where we think that is the challenge. As I said, we are not making a view that the FMC is disempowered from regulating, nor that there could be justifications for regulations. To the extent that they say things like there needs to be more specificity in the billing, timely billing, things of that nature, we're not challenging that. We don't disagree. This is a very important range of billing where this is reasonable, and that's what we're focused on, Your Honor.
Okay, and then there are other options to remand without vacater and then also severability. Could you just speak to those issues as to...
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. On severability, again, we're focused on 541.4. I don't think we join issue on vacater. On severability. On vacater, a few points about that. Of course, the standard remedy is vacater. My friends make an argument solely by footnote in their brief suggesting against vacater. As this court has long precedent in the CTS case, et cetera, that a skeletal argument and footnote doesn't really advance it. And I think that's true here because they make two points. They say that there'd be disruptive consequences, but they say that in one conclusory sentence without any explanation as to why returning to the status quo ante, which has governed this industry for decades, would lead to disruptive consequences. And I don't think it can be disruptive because our position is that we turn on the existence of contracts. All we want to do is be able to enforce existent contracts. That's not disruptive to be able to enforce those contracts that are disruptive. And the second point is they say that they can cure deficiencies, but again, that's a single conclusory sentence with no justification or warrant by footnote as to why the court should have depart from the general approach of a vacater here.
But from your perspective, as Judge Childs was highlighting, there's no reason to deal with vacater of any part of the rule other than the specific part that you're concerned with. The rest of the rule can stay intact.
We're focused on this issue in 541.4.
Let me just make sure I understand your arbitrary and capricious argument. Is your argument that to the extent that the commission says that it's only going to allow invoicing with parties that are in contractual privity with the ocean carriers or the marine terminal operators, you don't dispute that proposition, You're just saying that they didn't implement that proposition, or they didn't implement that theory of efficiency, or however you want to put it. Is that your argument?
Yes, sir. That's why, and again, I know it's not in the rule, but that's why my client, before bringing this petition for review, wrote to the commission, because what my client wants is exactly what the preamble of the text said. They just want that reduced to the actual operative rule. So what we are asking for is for what the FMC said in its preamble text was the result to actually, in fact, be the result. So that is the net result that we are requesting.
Thank you.
Can I just ask you one question about statutory part? Not because I necessarily think we need to get to it, but I'm just curious about this. And this is your second statutory argument. In 41102, the provision speaks in terms of a common carrier, marine terminal operator, or ocean transportation intermediary cannot fail to establish, observe, and enforce just and reasonable regulations and practices, et cetera. Are the regulations that's being referred to in that, is that regulations of the regulated parties, or is it regulations of the agency that regulates?
I think because it says regulations and practices, Your Honor, I think it is confusing, but I believe that is talking about the practices of the parties, not the regulations of FMC. And this language, as we talk about in the briefs, is common in statutes where commissions govern the
tariffs and
tariff system. So it's common in the FERC context and elsewhere. And let me just add a point there that we made in our opening brief. It's at Joint Appendix 41. This is the interpretive rule that's so critical. And this just points out the commission sees the statutory construction the same way. The commission says the commission may, quote unquote, issue regulations prohibiting certain practices determined to be unjust and unreasonable, and the DC Circuit has affirmed this authority. That's what the commission says in the interpretive rule. We agree with that. That's how we think the statute works under 41102. They just have to make the determination that the practices they're prescribing are unjust and unreasonable. And with respect to situations where there is a actual contract between ocean carrier and motor carrier, there's been no finding that it's unjust and unreasonable. Rather, it's to the contrary. The struck part of the preamble suggests it is reasonable. And the part of the preamble that talks about marine terminal operators says, of course, it's reasonable when you're operating pursuant to a tariff, which, again, isn't a one-on-one contract. It is an implied in law contract. We're talking about where our client, our members have
express
real contracts with motor carriers to finish the completion of the freight's journey.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give you a little time for rebuttal. Mr. Summers.
Good morning. So contrary to what the court may have heard, the commission did not agree with the Shipping Council's interpretation of its rule. Our position is that the regulatory text itself has always been very clear. Not just the regulatory text itself has been very clear that trucker billing is not allowed in this context, but the NPRM was very clear about what the agency was proposing. The preamble itself, in every other location except for the one paragraph that's been discussed, was very clear that billing truckers was not permitted in this circumstance. And then the correction that's been discussed was, again, very clear. Truckers can't be billed in this circumstance. So
the one paragraph was very clear in the opposite direction.
Your Honor, it was a garbled paragraph, as we pointed out.
I mean, it seemed to me actually wasn't garbled. It seemed to me it was clear. It may have been garbled as to what the result of that is, but the paragraph itself spoke pretty clearly. Put it this way, suppose there was no regulatory text and all you had was that paragraph. Wouldn't it be pretty clear what that paragraph said?
I understand the reading. I understand that reading. It did not reflect the commission's position, that paragraph. I think it's fair to say that it was at best ambiguous and erroneous, and it was something, that's why we chose to correct the text and make it extra clear. It really did not, it was not consistent with all of the other elements that I've mentioned. Most importantly, the crystal clear regulation itself. The regulation was issued at the same time as that preamble. So that's, the regulation is what.
Actually, I mean, to me, it actually does seem pretty, the paragraph that was that was sought to be excised by the correction actually seems pretty consistent with a lot of what's in the rule, because it's focused on whether there's a contract. And the idea, the underlying principle is that the contracting party is in the best position. And so we ought to make sure that the fee is directed against a contracting party. And then we do, I think your understanding would be totally understandable if there were never a situation in which the motor carrier could have a contract. Then everything fits together. But I don't think you dispute that there are situations in which a motor carrier can not just have the implied contract, which is discussed in the rule, but actually have an express contract. And if there is an express contract, then it seems to me to be fairly consistent with the rule, absent some explanation to the contrary that I'm not sure is in here, as to why that what was in that paragraph wouldn't be what you would expect, which is in those situations in which there is a contract, yeah, you can put the fee against that contracting party, consistent with everything else we're saying here, that the focus ought to be on the contracting party.
Your Honor, I think the distinction that's important to get is the contract that matters, the one under Section 541.4, is the contract for ocean carriage. That's the contract made between the shipper and the carrier, not a carrier haulage contract. That's a different contract, and I'll get to that in a minute. But the one that the rule focuses on is who is a party to the ocean carriage contract, and that's not truckers. So they're not part of that contract. It's not a general contract privity standard. It's based on who is a party to.
And was the ocean, was that added as part of the correction?
No, that was always clear in the rule. It's right in the regulatory text of 541.4, which also contains a clear explanation of why MTOs can bill truckers. That's because they have a different type of contract for storage of cargo. Under 541.4, under the clear language of the rule, there's no inconsistency with the preamble's explanation that truckers can be billed by MTOs, because the rule specifically provides that different type of contract for storage of cargo, different from the ocean carriage contract, the kind of contract that MTOs make with truckers to store cargo on site. There's no inconsistency.
I'm not sure I understand you. So the MTOs, based on the terminal schedule, that's what you're talking about now?
Yes, that's right.
So what regulation allows the MTO to bill the truckers?
It is the same regulation that we're talking about. 541.4 refers to two different types of contracts. One is the contract for ocean carriage the shippers make with the ocean carriers, and the other is a contract for the storage of cargo. And that's the kind of contract that an MTO may make with a trucker. And that's why it's permissible for them to bill truckers. It's under the express terms of the rule. While we're on the express terms of the rule, it may be skipping ahead a bit, but in terms of the remedy, perhaps my colleague can explain further, but our understanding is what they're seeking here in this case is essentially to add truckers to the list of parties who can properly be billed. Certainly not, as Your Honor was asking, not to strike down the entire rule, but under my understanding, not even to strike down 541.4, but simply to add truckers to the list.
Let me ask you a question about language that appears at JA 257, which is page 14339 in the FMC response. It's in the bottom first column, where it says that after careful analysis, the commission has determined that prohibiting billing parties from issuing demurrage and detention invoices to persons with whom they do not have a contractual relationship will best benefit the supply chain. Has that language been modified or omitted or changed?
I think in that circumstance, Your Honor, the contract that was being discussed was the contract for ocean carriage. It's true that at times in the preamble, there is not a full statement of exactly which contract is being referred to, but that language that you've read was referring to the contract for ocean carriage. At times, as the discussion goes on within the preamble, it may be that it does not always include all clarifying language. It may start to abbreviate.
Okay, well, let's go to the next page, JA 258. In the far right column, so this is page 14340, of the Federal Register, volume 89. And there was a question about whether it's proper to allow consignees to be invoiced. And the commission responds that yes, it's proper, and that's where we're going to change the final rule to allow consignees to be billed when the consignee is the party contracting for the shipping and is therefore in contractual privity with the carrier. That language was never amended or in the preamble, right?
That was never changed, and it reflects my message that the contract that matters is the one for ocean carriage when we're talking about ocean carrier billing.
So where in the regulation does it say that the only consignees that can be invoiced are ones that have a contract with an ocean carrier?
I believe that is made clear in 541.4, Your Honor.
Where show me the language in 541.4 that says that, because all it says is that a properly issued invoice may be given to the consignee, and it doesn't say the consignee that's in privity. It just says consignee.
I believe my reading of the regulation is that it's party that has a contract for ocean transport or storage, and the consignee is listed after that.
Or the consignee. So what part of subparagraph one is grafted into subparagraph two? I mean, they're two separate things.
I think the idea, the overall reading that we would put forward for that is that the intention there is that the consignee is in a similar position to the shipper, or usually the shipper, and therefore that reflects the same basic analysis and the same underlying.
Here's my basic concern, and you tell me why I shouldn't have this concern. My concern is that the commission's reasoning seems to be that it's fair to invoice where there's contractual privity, but they omit some parties that have contractual privity from being invoiced, i.e. truckers. And then they include some parties, consignees, even without contractual privity, if I disagree with your reading of this regulation.
Your Honor,
so I come away with that feeling that the regulation is arbitrary and capricious because it doesn't implement what the commission said that it was trying to implement. So tell me why I shouldn't have that conclusion.
Your Honor, I think the standard is whether the parties involved are involved with the ocean carriage contract and are likely to be aware and are aware of the terms, especially the terms that relate to the charging of these late fees. So the commission's determination was that obviously it's the shippers who are making the contracts that set the terms, but also consignees typically are involved and aware of those terms as well, regardless of the exact way that their relationship to the agreement may be defined.
This one doesn't make if they're aware of the terms if they aren't in privity. I mean, how is a consignee, let's suppose that there's a contract between the ocean carrier and a motor carrier that says that the motor carrier under these circumstances would be responsible for the demurrage charges. Even if the consignee is aware of that contract, if the consignee gets invoiced for those demurrage charges, how are they going to recover that from the motor carrier? That contract, they're not a third party beneficiary, or what's their theory of liability to sue and recover from the motor carrier those demurrage charges?
Your Honor, if I understand the question, I think that kind of carrier haulage contract is a separate type of contract. I think that our rule only reaches demurrage and detention charges charged by, in this context, by the ocean carrier. If they were to, the rule would prohibit such charges being sent to the motor carriers, regardless of the contract. Congress said, determine who may
be. My point is, you say in your brief, and the commission said in the preamble, that look, if there's an instance where the consignee is invoiced for demurrage charges, but really the motor carrier is really the cause of those charges, and there's a contract between the ocean carrier and the motor carrier that specifies that under these circumstances, the motor carrier is responsible for those charges, that it's fine for the ocean carrier to invoice the consignee because ultimately they can recover from the motor carrier. And I'm asking you how.
Your Honor, I'm not sure if that's necessarily.
You don't think you said that in your brief?
If you say so, I think it may be that the parties to the ocean carriage contract have assumed the risk of certain causes to the delays that we're talking about that are outside the range of the rule. But we looking at the commission was trying to create a rule for the entire system that would help the whole system work in a more reasonable and efficient way. We're here focusing on a very specific event. It's the case that the ocean carriers have a lot of market power and they may make these carrier haulage contracts with the truckers. We're not saying that they have no remedies against the truckers. We're trying, because they do have those other contracts and they have a lot of market power, they have a lot of power to shape conduct of the truckers. But what we're saying is, in this system that we're trying to look at more broadly than the claim of the World Shipping Council, it serves the system best, including the incentive principle and the other principles in the interpretive rule, which include transparency and more efficient dispute resolution, to have this rule. This is where the commission drew the line based on the parties involved. It may be that in a particular circumstance, the rule doesn't align perfectly for everyone in the system, but our effort was to create an overall system that was more effective than the system that we saw before and that Congress identified as having significant abuses during the pandemic.
I'd like for you explain to me what you said on page 36 of your brief, which is that in the event that a third party, such as a trucker, is at fault for a delay, the billed parties have recourse against that third party for reimbursement, as they generally do have commercial relationships and strong incentives to continue those relationships. So how would that recourse work for a consignee that is billed for a demurrage charge that was the fault of a motor carrier?
Well, I think the consignee could dispute that charge and not—
Dispute it with who?
Dispute it with the ocean carrier and say—
What under the regulation would give them a leg to stand on?
Well, the regulations require that there be, if you look at the statute, section 41104D, which is the new provisions that govern the content of invoicing under for demurrage and detention, it specifies, I believe, 13 different elements that the invoices must have. And so they can object that the invoice—
Okay, so that's just about what the invoice has to include, let's say they included all of the things that they have to include. It's not about the substance of what the invoice, it's about just generally should they be responsible for paying it.
Well, in some of the elements do get into the substance of whether the invoice is properly created and properly directed, including, for example, I believe the last element requires that the carrier confirm that it did not cause or contribute to the delay itself. So some of those elements do—
That the carrier did not.
Yeah, that's right. So it's clear that Congress was—
So the ocean carrier is like, clear, I didn't contribute to the delay. The motor carrier did, but I'm going to go ahead and charge the consignee for the demurrage or the detention.
Well, I think it would be for the consignee to decline that. And, you know, this is based on a hypothetical—
Consignee could decline to pay the invoice.
I think they could say, yes. We're not responsible for this invoice. This isn't giving the carrier the right to collect from any either of the two entities identified
but
in the rule.
But doesn't the regulation say that they are properly invoiced for that?
They are properly invoiced as a category, a type of party, but that doesn't mean that every bill sent to that party is necessarily payable. It has to meet other requirements.
So what happens if they refuse to pay it and the ocean carrier says, you owe us this money and you either pay it or we'll sue you or we won't, you know, deliver any more product to you?
Well, I think
what happens then?
You've identified mechanisms by which the carrier could seek recourse in the event that some bill that they've sent is not paid. And that's true also in terms of their billing of motor carriers, which they seek to want to do. I mean, what's really at issue here is that when they have a contract with a motor carrier, they want to be able to bill that party. And
but you said in your brief that the consignee would have recourse against the trucker. That's what you say at page 34.
How do they
have recourse against the trucker?
I believe what that language is trying to say was that the ocean carrier would have recourse, not the consignee would have recourse.
You said the billed parties will have recourse against the third party being the trucker. So how is the ocean carrier the billed party? They are the billing party.
Yes, that's true. If we said that may have been erroneous. But I think the consignee could contact the motor carrier and seek to negotiate reimbursement. I mean, if they felt that they were responsible for the charge. So these are general rules, and there may be circumstances when they don't work perfectly, but in an effort to look at the entire system holistically and create rules that would improve the prior system as Congress directed the commission to do, Congress did direct the commission to determine who may be appropriately billed.
So can I go back on that score? I'll make sure I'm not interrupted. On that score, can I go back to this question about how we apply the scenario, how we apply under the regulation, the scenario in which the motor carrier has a contractual relationship with the MTO under a schedule, which is discussed at JA 257 and 258. So I take it that what you're saying now, I just want to make sure I understand your argument that you started with. You're saying that in that situation, actually, the regulation does allow for invoicing the motor carrier, and that's because that's a storage of cargo contract.
That's right.
And so therefore, under 541.4A1, the motor carrier is a party
that
can be invoiced. And so if that's the case, then I'm going to be interested to hear what the other side says on this, because I assume that's going to be news to them. But if that, unless I'm misunderstanding the context entirely, but if that's the case, then why was it at 257 and 258 of the joint appendix in the preamble, there's no reference to the regulation? I mean, it says that such schedules are enforceable as implied contracts, and it references 46 USC 405.01F and 46 CFR 525.2A2. Wouldn't it have been easy just to say, well, under the regulation, this is totally permissible. That's why it speaks in terms of storage contracts.
I understand that concern, Your Honor. I think it number one, it's not directly at issue in this case, but it may well be that it would have been better.
It's kind of an issue, because I think we're just trying to understand the extent to which there's some rationale in the rule for why circumstances in which motor carriers who are in express contractual privity with the billing party can't be invoiced. And this is speaking about that. And you've made the representation that the regulation actually did mean to cover that in this particular context of the schedules. And it meant to cover that by use of the term storage of cargo. And I'm just wondering if that's the answer. That seems like that would have been a very straightforward answer to put in the preamble, but it's not in there, which makes me wonder whether that is in fact the right way to read the regulation.
Your Honor, it may be that there was an assumption at that point in the preamble that had been gone over earlier. I believe the ANPRM may have discussed the differences in those contracts as well, between the contract for storage of cargo versus ocean carriage. So
is that discussed beforehand in detail? And Okay.
I believe it is discussed in the.
But there's not even a reference to the terms of the regular. I had not appreciated this argument before, and maybe I missed it somewhere, but I had not appreciated this argument that there's a storage of contract. There's a storage of cargo contract that allows for the levying of the invoice under the terms of the regulation. And I guess it's just surprising to me that that wouldn't have been explained in the exact part of the preamble in which this issue is discussed.
Right. I think it was in the ANPRM that there was a discussion of the different types of contracts covered, and that the distinction between this contract for storage of cargo versus the ocean carriage contract may have been spelled out. That might have been at 87 Federal Register 8507. That's the site I have. But okay. In any event, I think that point of the preamble, there may have been an assumption that the regulatory language was clear, but it may well have benefited from the kind of explanation you're pointing to. I don't disagree.
And then the next sentence says, this is a very different situation than where a motor carrier, It's a very different situation than where a motor carrier is billed for demurrage or detention, and the motor carrier has no contractual relationship with the billing party and is not privy to the specifics of the contractual agreement. I mean, if I read that sentence, then I would have thought the negative pregnant of that is a situation in which the motor carrier is in a contractual relationship with the billing party and therefore is privy to the specifics of the contractual agreement. But there's at least some circumstances in which that's the case where you'd say, well, even though that's the case, the regulation still bars invoicing the motor carrier.
Yes, where they are in privity in that context is when there's a contract for storage of cargo. So perhaps it could have been more clearly stated there.
But I'm right in saying that the upshot of your view is that even in situations which the preamble denominates as very different, but even in situations in which a motor carrier has a contractual relationship with the billing party and is privy to the specifics of the contractual agreement, the motor carrier still cannot be invoiced. That regulation encompasses at least some of those situations. I get in your argument now that when you're talking about storage contracts, it doesn't encompass those, but there are other situations in which there is an express contract and there's privity and therefore awareness of the specifics, but nonetheless, the regulation bars the invoicing of the motor carrier.
Yes, I think that's right, Your Honor. And I think when Congress told the commission to define which parties may be appropriately billed, they expected the agency, they weren't saying define it unless the ocean carrier wants to make a different contractual arrangement with one of the another party like a motor carrier. The Congress meant for us to define who can be properly billed as a general category. So yes, that would exclude motor carriers where they were not parties to the operative contract, the one that we're concerned with, the one that sets the terms of demurrage and detention.
Okay.
So I realize I'm over time. If I could just make a couple, you may have more questions.
Yeah, I just wanted to go into just a little bit about the contradiction or the correction that once you became aware of that contradiction between the preamble and the final text, final rule rather, it just seemed like it was treated pretty much ministerial. And so I wanted to know, do you consider there to be a more formal process generally rather than these emails? And does a correction generally become part of the final rule?
I think the correction modifies the preamble to the final rule. I mean, the terms used here can be confusing. The final rule often refers to the entire publication that includes the regulatory text plus the preamble. There's been no change to the regulation. Mm-hmm. There has been a change to the lengthy explanation of the regulation that is the preamble to make sure it's consistent with every other part of the preamble where billing of truckers in this setting was clearly rejected and the council clearly understood that. Because
council is also asking that all of that information be amended or included in the record.
That's correct, Your Honor. We don't think that's appropriate. I think those were informal guidance-oriented emails involving FMC staff, as was noted earlier. That's not the same as the statement of the commission.
But there's also no ability to comment on any of that information.
Our position is that it wouldn't be required to have notice and comment for something that was merely correcting one paragraph of a preamble.
You didn't consider that substantive?
It's no change at all to the regulation. It is clarifying and correcting arguably erroneous information in one paragraph of a preamble. So I believe that meets the standard for something that the agency can just correct. And it was done before the effective date of the rule. So there's no real potential for confusion. As far as the emails go, I think in the early stages, there was an effort to understand what was being requested and to reconcile the preamble text with the at issue with the remainder. When greater understanding occurred and it was clear what the question was, the main focus of those emails was to ask the council to direct a formal request to the commission to clarify or change the rule. And that's something that the council can do anytime. We've noted there's been no real evidence presented that this is a substantial problem for the council other than hypotheticals and general descriptions. But if the council wishes to request that the commission reconsider the substance of the rule, identifying evidence as to the problems it's causing them, it's always free to do that. But okay, it hasn't done that, it's filed suit. So
certainly. Then one last point. Your opposing counsel has asked that 541.4 be vacated with respect to the rule. What's your position on that, or is severability an option?
I think that it need not be vacated because their objection appears to be so limited. Our understanding is that they have not challenged the current structure of 541.4 in terms of saying, here are the parties who can be billed. This type, that type. I think my reading, and my friend can clarify, is that they wish a third category to be added, and that is motor carriers when they have a contract with the ocean carrier for carrier haulage. I think that's a very limited addition. I don't think that would require even vacating 541.4, but a remand with instructions to modify and explain would make more sense, because at this point, when the rule has been in effect for almost a year, it would be disruptive to reverse to the prior system, I think, at this point. And it is something that an explanation-based objection could be addressed in that way, at a minimum.
Thank you.
I have a question. If there's an ocean carrier that entered into a contract with motor carriers, let's say in 2020, where that said that the motor carriers would be responsible for demurrage and detention charges, when those charges were incurred through the fault of the motor carrier. Let's so say that those contracts existed beginning in 2020. With the promulgation of this rule, those ocean carriers can't invoice those motor carriers anymore, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So the rule has the effect of essentially abrogating those contracts to the extent that such a contract exists.
I do think federal law would generally take precedence over a private contract once it's in effect. Once it's in effect, yes.
So how is that consistent with your friends on the other side in their opening brief at page 10 talk about the Shipping Act of 1984 and what its purposes are? And it says that one of the purposes of the commission is to regulate common carriage of goods by water and the foreign commerce of the United States with a minimum of government intervention and regulatory costs. And then they go on to say that another thing that it directs the commission to do is to ensure an efficient, competitive, economical transportation system, et cetera, by placing a greater reliance on the marketplace. So to the extent that this kind of underlying statute, Congress expressed an intent for the commission to regulate in such a way that there's a minimum of government intervention and there's a greater reliance on the marketplace,
How is a regulation that abrogates a contract that was negotiated by parties to deal with this issue consistent with that statute? How is that efficient? How is that placing a greater reliance on the marketplace?
Your Honor, I think that was the impetus of the 1984 revision to the Act, but I would, or rather the 1984 Shipping Act, but there have been revisions since then, and the most recent one in 2022, the Ocean Shipping Reform Act of 2022, where Congress directed us to create a rule like this, was clearly pushing in a more regulatory direction because of the abuses in the system that Congress and the Commission observed during the pandemic. Abuses that are clear from the legislative record, that are clear from the Commission's fact-finding 29 investigation. So I would say—
Are you saying that the 2022 Act somehow overruled what Congress said in the 84 Act?
The 2022 Act was a more specific direction to regulate in a very specific area, a very limited area of the Act that I would call it revising and refining the Act. And that's what the Commission tried to do with its rule, to follow Congress's direction based on what Congress saw and documented during the pandemic, to create a more refined and, yes, to some extent, more expanded regulation in this area. And that's clear from the statutory changes that the Ocean Shipping Reform Act of 2022 created in 41-104D and F, where Congress was clearly very concerned to limit the types of billing, the parties to whom you could send these bills, and also regulate what the bills could say. So I think it's correct to say that the 1984 Act was deregulatory relative to what was seen before. But I think Congress's more recent direction is in the other direction and does authorize what we did here.
Thank you, Council. Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Council. Mr. Hughes, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to start with the new argument about the marine terminal, Your Honor's right, that's not one we had seen before. I don't think that argument works, though, for a few reasons. The first is 541 talks about billing the party on whose account the storage is for. There's no sense that the storage is for the account of the motor carrier. That's my first point. The second is when you look at the regulatory text, it also says that the marine terminals can bill for detention. Well, detention has nothing to do with storage. That is about keeping the containers out for too long and preventing them to come back into the flow of freight fluidity. So that also doesn't work for that second reason. And my third point is, even if we're wrong about all that, which I don't think we are, this was just an additional example of this rule being arbitrary and capricious. I don't think it takes away from our broader showing that the whole purpose of this rule is about contractual privity. And that's what our essential point here is the preamble as written, which focuses on enforcing contracts, and that's fair for all parties involved. We think the preamble yields a sensible result. The problem is 554.4 does not achieve what the preamble described. That's arbitrary and capricious, failure to give reasons, failure to respond to comments. In terms of remedy, we do think that vacating 541.4 is the critical issue. It's the set-aside relief under the APA. It's because 541.4 is what is harming us. It's precluding our members from billing motor carriers pursuant to existing contracts that these arm's-length parties have already negotiated. That's what is causing the harm. I don't think this court can pull out a pen and add motor carriers to a list. That's not a remedy that we have available. The remedy that we have is a set aside of the provision. We're not asking for a broad set aside of the whole regulatory package, rather the sole piece of the regulation that harms us.
They say that there's no evidence in the record that such contracts exist.
That is inaccurate, Your Honor, and I can describe this for a bunch of reasons. First, the fact that these contracts, these carrier haulage contracts, were described in such length in the original preamble at 254, demonstrates that they exist. There's substantial record evidence of this. So in the interpretive rule at J61, the Maritime Commission describes carrier haulage at length and describes how this is a common way of shipping. When I say carrier haulage, I mean that's distinct from merchant haulage. Carrier haulage is a scenario in which the ocean carrier has a contract not just to deliver the freight to a port, but to deliver it to the consignee, wherever the purchaser, the customer, its preferred place. In those circumstances, the ocean carrier always has to contract with inland transportation, which is typically with motor carriers. The record evidence talks about, for example, the Port of New York and New Jersey. This is a J195 footnote 9. 85% of that cargo is moved via truck. The third reason that this is described is in the World Shipping Council comment at pages J214 to 215, we explain this scenario and the commonality of it. Our brief fourth provides a reply 16 to 17 cases that talk about this carrier haulage and disputes between motor carriers and ocean carriers demonstrating this occurs. This is a frequent pattern. You can look to the Supreme Court's decision in Norfolk Southern versus Kirby that talks about these, it's called a through bill of lading, the through bill of lading that brings the goods to the ultimate destination is quite common. In all of those situations with a through bill of lading, you have carrier haulage. And then
as the email traffic said, I think the email traffic confirms this idea about a through bill of lading.
Yes, Your Honor. It's exactly right. It's a through bill of lading. And then the last point, Your Honor, is when standing was challenged, not talked about, I don't think there's a real challenge there, but we put up five member declarations. And when the court looks to those member declarations, each of them talk about existing contracts that those five members of ours presently have with motor carriers that are impaired by this rule. So that is in the declarations that we attach to our reply brief to demonstrate standing. I think there's an abundance of evidence that this is very frequent. And again, we're here on behalf of the ocean liner shipping industry because this matters an enormous deal. At the end of the day, the preamble is written, makes sense. It's about contractual privity. It's about enforcing contracts. The notion that demurrage and detention has problems in the absence of contracts, we don't dispute. We think the preamble as written leads to a sensible place. The regulation simply did not adopt that. That's arbitrary and capricious, and there should be set aside of the sole portion of the regulation that bars billing in these circumstances.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.